Hello, this is Doug Belshaw. So, Today in Digital Education is a podcast that Di Barnes and I record on a regular basis. There is no Tide, as it's known this week, because Di is on holiday and I've had visitors. So instead, in lieu of a written blog post, I thought I'd read something that I've been writing over the last couple of days, because I'm not going to publish this in text form, someone else's. And that person is Ben Williamson. He's at Ben Patrick Will on Twitter. Now, Ben invited me up to the University of Stirling, where he lectures, at the end of last year, 2014. Ben writes for DML Central, as I do. He's a lecturer at Stirling, and he kind of writes about policy stuff to do with software, data, algorithms, code, education, that kind of intersection. And he got some funding to do some work around the kind of public nature of code. So, if you go to the blog codeactsineducation.wordpress.com, you can see the seminar series, you can see who was involved. And it was a really enjoyable day. There was some really stimulating thinking, some stimulating talks, and my talk seemed to be pretty well received as well. So off the back of that, he's asked me to write something, which will go into an ebook. And because I can't really publish that ahead of time, I'm just going to read it to you. We'll see how this goes. So I've given it the title, Web Literacy, What Happens Beyond Peak Centralization and Software with Shareholders. It's a short abstract, and I'll read the article itself. And I'd be really interested in your feedback, actually. So the abstract is, we're at peak centralization of our data in online services, with data as the new oil. It's a time of frictionless sharing, but also a time when we're increasingly having decisions made on our behalf by algorithms. Education is now subject to a land grab by software with shareholders looking to profit from collecting, mining, packaging, and selling learner data. This article explores some of the issues at stake, as well as pointing towards the seeds of a potential solution. That's the end of the abstract. So here we go. In 2009, a design firm called Information Architects produced their fourth iteration of a web trends map. As with previous versions, they set it out in the style of the Tokyo subway, with websites grouped and located by association. This was the height of the Web 2.0 era, a hugely creative and liberating force in the tech industry, meaning that for the first time the average web user could not only consume the web, but publish to it. According to Flu, 2008, it signaled, quote, a move from personal websites to blogs and blog site aggregation, from publishing to participation, from web content as the outcome of large upfront investment to an ongoing and interactive process, and from content management systems to links based on tagging, brackets folksonomy, end of brackets, end of quotation. The problem. Interestingly, the way that Information Architects chose to portray the largest websites of the day is very much reminiscent of agricultural silos. This is an apt metaphor, as silos exist to keep things discrete and separate. Although the tenets of Web 2.0 had been interoperability and openness, intense competition led to vertical integration, and this was hastened by the confluence of a burgeoning and lucrative native app ecosystem, and with the impact of the worldwide economic slowdown. In short, technology companies sought to lock users into their platform. This kind of move has its analogue in the territorial imperialism of the 19th century. Recent developments around internet.org, a project from Facebook, confirms this trend. In return for free access to hand-picked websites, so-called zero rating, the principles of the open web are undermined. Quote, the impact of zero rating may result in the same harms as throttling, blocking, or paid prioritization. By giving one company, or a handful, the ability to reach users at no cost to them, zero rating could limit rather than expand a user's access to the internet, and ultimately chill competition and innovation. The promise of the internet as a driver of innovation is that anyone can make anything and share it with anyone. Without a level playing field, the world won't benefit from the next Facebook, Google, or Twitter. Dixon Thayer, 2015. The approach taken by internet.org has been labelled by the Electronic Frontier Foundation, EFF, a non-profit set up to defend user rights in the digital world, as a ghetto for poor users instead of a stepping stone to the larger internet. Even worse, instead of a tool for human flourishing, it could become an instrument of oppression for users in third world countries. Quote, "By setting themselves up as gatekeepers for free access to portions of the global internet, Facebook and its partners have issued an open invitation for governments and special interest groups to lobby, cajole, or threaten them to withhold particular content from their service. In other words, internet.org will be much easier to censor than a true global internet." Galula and Malcolm, 2015. One of the main reasons technology companies seek to expand their number of users is because, as publicly traded organizations, they are legally obliged to maximize shareholder value. Their services are provided free at the point of access for users. So the profits of tech companies such as Google, Twitter, and Facebook are generated through data mining and selling this targeted data to advertisers. They are providing, in effect, software with shareholders. Data, then, is often seen as the new oil. It is a source of huge wealth and opportunity for those who control the giant technology silos within which we learn, socialize, and transact. Startups that create apps that attract large user bases are purchased for eye-watering amounts of money, even before they are profitable. An example of this would be WhatsApp, the instant messaging app for smartphones, bought by Facebook in 2014 for $22 billion. The oil metaphor can be instructive in terms of the way we approach this new landscape. Instead of data mining with abandon, perhaps we could, as Ger Thorpe pleads in his 2012 Harvard Business Review article, bring some much-needed criticality to bear. Quote, "Our experience with oil has been fraught. Fortunes made have been balanced with dwindling resources, bloody mercenary conflicts, and a terrifying climate crisis. If we are indeed making the first steps into economic terrain that will be as transformative, and possibly as risky, as that of the petroleum industry, foresight will be key. We've already seen data spills happen when large amounts of personal data are inadvertently leaked. Will it be much longer until we see dangerous data drilling practices, or until we start to see long-term effects from data pollution?" Thorpe, 2012. One of the fastest growing areas in tech is the burgeoning field of so-called big data. Using large data sets, algorithms are let loose to find correlations. Acting on the results of this data mining process in the tech world is often called growth hacking. In the world of education, it's known as learning analytics. In both cases, the data exhaust of users is analyzed to an unprecedented degree. Interactions with friends, colleagues, and peers are cross-referenced for trends and patterns. In the case of tech companies such as Facebook, it's been found that their extremely long user agreement allowed them to conduct a large psychological experiment on almost 700,000 users of the social network, McNeil, 2014. As part of the experiment, the news feed of users was manipulated to assess the effect on their emotions. This social contagion research, which some sources claim was funded in part by the US military, was successful. The researchers were able to affect emotions based on manipulating Facebook news feeds. This was only made public, however, due to the results being published in an academic journal, Kramer, Gilroy, and Hancock, 2014. In the case of learning analytics, it could be argued that data mining to ascertain patterns of engagement and behavior is a positive use of such data. The aim here, after all, is to intervene to prevent the individual dropping out of university and to ensure they have the help required to succeed on a course. However, with an increased move towards the marketization and commercialization of higher education, this cannot be seen in neutral terms. In the case of both growth hacking and learner analytics, the aim is to use data generated by, but not necessarily accessible to, users in ways they may never have imagined. Towards a solution. There are many groups fighting for user rights on the web. Two of these, the EFF and Mozilla, have been mentioned above as expressing concern over Facebook's internet.org initiative. Mozilla in particular has been very active in efforts to inform and educate the public about the skills and competencies required to read, write, and participate on the web. To this end, the Mozilla Foundation worked with a community of stakeholders on a web literacy map. The latest iteration at the time of writing is version 1.1. Each strand, explore, build, connect, contains five competencies, with each competency containing in turn a number of skills. Each skill is framed in terms of action and phrased in a way that can be achieved at multiple levels. The aim is for the web literacy map to be the raw material from which learning activities and curricula can be devised. Most relevant to the current discussion is the web mechanics competency, containing the following skills: using and understanding the differences between URLs, IP addresses, and search terms; identifying where data is on the network of devices that makes up the internet; exporting, moving, and backing up data from web services; explaining the role algorithms play in creating and managing content on the web; creating or modifying an algorithm to serve content from around the web. Through carefully planned activities, developing these skills also cultivates habits of mind in web users, allowing them to curate their own information environment. This means users are equipped to be effective in any kind of digital environment. Quote, "Being aware of the way that tools shape the way we think and interact with the world is the first step on the way to changing behaviors. As learners, as teachers, as citizens, we have a duty to ourselves and to one another to be mindful of this." Belshaw, 2014b. Building upon technical standards is a long-established trend with the web. We need to do likewise with our teaching and learning about how the web works. Building upon iterative, crowdsourced standards such as Mozilla's Web Literacy Map allows us to shape the web we want, rather than the distorted view that suits shareholders. Okay, well, I hope that was decent. I think the ending could be slightly stronger, so I'd be interested in your thoughts about that. I am butting up to the word limit, so I might have to cut some stuff out if I do change it. But let me know in the comments if you think this is half decent, anything you disagree with, anything you vehemently do agree with, that would be fantastic. And I'll put the references in there for your perusal as well. Thanks for listening.